Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Emily Dufton. Today, my guest is Joseph Graffier, who worked as a statistician for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for nearly 40 years. Between 1988 and 2013, he was the lead federal official responsible for managing the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, or NISDA, one of the federal government's largest and most important ongoing health surveys. For 50 years, NISDA has measured Americans' use of illegal drugs, prescription drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. Graffier managed the survey through five presidential administrations and through countless drug scares and policy shifts until he retired in 2014. As the author of dozens of peer-reviewed journal articles and book chapters and hundreds of government reports, Graffier is a widely recognized expert on survey methodology and how to use statistics to measure drug use. His new book, War Stories from the Drug Survey, How Culture, Politics, and Statistics Shaped the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, came out in 2019. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I'd like to start by asking you a bit about yourself. You're a statistician by trade and an expert in survey methodology. How did you become interested in statistics? What got you into this field?
Well, I think as a child, I was interested in math. I liked math, and I did well with math in school. And I was also really a baseball fan and a baseball player, and I loved everything about baseball. And so there were a lot of statistics in baseball. And you're collecting baseball cards. You get all the stats on the back of the cards, and there were books with a lot of interesting statistics, and really got into that. Plus, I was interested in, I like playing board games, and ended up making up my own games, cards, and learned a lot in that. Probably lost all bulls and probably think joint contributions. And so when I got into college and finally took a probability course, I really realized that I really liked this stuff, and it came natural to me, and so I decided to get a major in statistics, which is what I did at the University of Buffalo.
So tell me more about how you got involved with public service. Did you always want to work for the federal government?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. When I was in college, getting towards the end of my undergraduate work, I applied to all kinds of jobs, and one was the federal government, and I ended up getting a call from somebody at the National Center for Health Statistics about a job there, and looked pretty interesting to me, and it was pretty much the only serious offer I got for a job right out of college. And so I took the job. It meant moving from Buffalo to Washington, D.C., but I wanted to go where I could find a job that interested me, and it turned out pretty well. I really liked working in the government and came to really love working in public service, and particularly in statistics, where the the data are used for, you know, good purposes in terms of helping improve public health and really saving lives, as I learned early on in talking with some of the other statisticians, that the data really have important uses for public health.
Right. So how did you get involved then with the National Survey on Drug Use and Health? Did you have any interest in studying patterns of drug use before?
Well, not really. In working at NCHS, I was involved in lots of different health surveys, including the Health Interview Survey, the largest survey that the Department of Health and Human Services does, and also the Hospital Discharge Survey, and really all of the surveys they did there. And I worked with a lot of really good statisticians and public health analysts and learned a lot about the data. And after about 4 years, I decided to look around for something else. And turned out there was the National Institute on Drug Abuse was looking for a statistician, and they brought me in, and I switched over to them. It was a whole different environment where, instead of being in a large statistical agency with lots of different statisticians surveys, it was a very really just vision of statistical statisticians and data sets. And they were in the process in '80. They were in the process of building a statistical unit that included most of the primary surveys related to drug abuse in the federal base. The hospital emergency departments, and they had surveys of treatment programs and people in treatment. And they also had this pretty small survey of the general population, the household survey on drug abuse. And so that's how I ended up getting involved in that. After a few years working there, they needed somebody to take charge of that survey. And so they decided I was the right person. I had all the background in survey work at NCHS that helped me qualify for being in charge of that one survey. And then, as it turned out, right after I took over the survey, it became much more prominent in the government as a primary survey because of the interest in more drug data at the time. And so the survey began expanding at that time.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time for you to be at NIDA. NIDA only really came into being a couple of years before you started. So you're kind of getting in at the ground floor and getting in with NISDA at the ground floor. You're watching it evolve. But before we get into what it became, I'd love to talk a little bit about where the survey came from. So if any of our listeners have read my book, Grassroots, they'll know that Raymond Schaefer, a certain former Republican governor of my home state of Pennsylvania, he plays a big role in both of our books, which just about made me fall off my chair when I was reading yours. So where did the National Survey on Drug Use and Health come from, and what does Raymond Schaefer have to do with it?
Yes, well, this is something, a whole topic that I really learned about after I retired when I was working on the book, because it was just a few years before I came to NIDA. I knew a lot of the people that were involved from the beginning, but we never really talked about the details of it. But really the survey began with as sort of a component of President Nixon's drug war. He declared a war on drugs back around 1970, and
it is the 50th anniversary of Nixon's declaration of the drug war today, the day we are recording, June 17th, 2021. He made the announcement on June 17th, 1971. So it's very appropriate for us to be speaking about this today. It's a moment of historical kismet for this.
yeah, I didn't know that. The plan at the time, of course, there was lots of legislation, one of the first steps was to create this commission to study the drug problem and make recommendations as to what to do about it. And as most people know, the 60s were a period of really increasing drug use among young people, starting with the college students. And at the same time, this was during the Vietnam War, and there were lots of protests about the war, and a lot of people weren't happy about it. And it was also a direct connection to drug use, in that some of the soldiers were coming back with drug problems because the drug use was so rampant in Southeast Asia, particularly heroin use, the heroin being widely available in Vietnam. But so Nixon, in terms of politics, he made the connection between the drug use culture among young people and the protest against the war, which is what he perceived as very bad for him, and the people who were protesting were kind of on his enemies list in general. And so his idea of tying in the drug problem with the anti-war movement was that he could punish and keep under control some of the protesters by also controlling and punishing drug users. But he set up this commission to study and recommend policies related to the drug abuse. But he created the commission with people friendly to his point of view, including the former governor of Pennsylvania, Ray Schaefer, who I guess had the reputation of being very hard line on drug use, drug enforcement. And so Nixon was expecting a report that would recommend strong penalties for marijuana use and other things that would, rely on enforcement and arresting people. Well, the first thing the commission did was, of course, they reviewed lots of existing research studies that were in the literature, but they all felt like they needed to collect their own data, do their own survey to find out what was really going on in the population, and partly because to get the use estimates, but really just as importantly was the attitudes about drug use and what to do about it. So turns out there was another commission and another study that had been done earlier on pornography in America. And there was a researcher and a research organization called Response Analysis Corporation, run by Herb Abelson, that had done a national household survey asking questions about pornography, people's use of pornography and attitudes about it. And they had developed a methodology that was appropriate and worked well in getting accurate responses about sensitive behaviors, sensitive issues like pornography and illegal drug use. And it's really based around the idea that privacy is important. If people are given an opportunity to answer questions in private, they will reveal their secrets and their things that they might not report in an open interview or telephone interview. So the way it worked was using self-administered answer sheets. The questions were put on paper answer sheets, handed to the respondents. It was face-to-face. These were interviews done in people's homes all over the country. And the responses were written on the sheet without the interviewer seeing them. And then they were put into an envelope, sealed right on the spot, and mailed. It could have been mailed. The interview into a mailbox and dropped to a research facility. But the respondents were invited to walk with them and see that it was put in the mailbox. So all these procedures were put in place, promises of confidentiality and procedures that were promoting the privacy. And that was the methodology that then was used on the drug survey. And although it changed forms and was expanded and improved on over the years, it was that core methodology that persists today in the survey.
That's really remarkable that you know, the survey itself is so interesting because it's trying to generate national numbers on something most people don't want to admit to doing, you know, illegal drugs. And I think this is a problem that a lot of doctors and school counselors and others run into, you know, getting people to admit to drug use so you can actually see its impact on the population, health statistics, things like that. I think that idea that you're, the methodology of the drug use survey was sort of formed around similar useful methods from a pornography survey is a really, I mean, you're going to talk about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I guess I never associated those with federal government statistics, and yet here's the link. This is sort of, you know, how the methodology was formed. I think that's great. The survey starts during a period when, as you said, Richard Nixon is really focused on marijuana, and it reflected that. What changes did the survey undergo when other drugs, and I'm thinking specifically of crack cocaine here, when they came on the scene?
Yes. One thing that I wanted to mention about the initial surveys, they were really focused on marijuana and attitudes. And the big result of the survey was that the population, while it really, most people felt that marijuana was dangerous drug, and it was harmful to the health. The research studies that they reviewed were had actually been studied in different kinds of ways, determined that it really wasn't that dangerous if it wasn't used, you know, too excessively. And so there was a little bit of a conflict, but that was a big result of the survey. Now, of course, the president, Nixon, didn't like that and tried to have it changed. But to his credit, Ray Schaefer, he reported the results accurately, and it didn't change Nixon's policies. He still favored the enforcement and still pushed for marijuana being illegal at the federal level, which it still is today. That was an example of how the politicians and the scientists don't always, you know, agree on how the survey should be designed. And so a few years later, the initial survey was done by this commission. They did two surveys, and then a couple years later, in 1974, the National Institute on Drug Abuse was created, and that's when they decided to make it actually a federal government ongoing survey. And so they kept the same design pretty much, and it changed in terms of the questionnaire, you know, over the years. But in the 1980s, when cocaine became a prominent problem, particularly crack cocaine, there were some realizations that it really wasn't sufficient. And first of all, we had the issue with crack cocaine in the early 80s. And because the survey was done every 2 or 3 years, and because of the lead time to design the questionnaire and get the right questions on the survey, it really became clear that the survey was not sufficient in its design to pick up emerging drugs like that. So when I came on, became involved in the survey before the 1985 survey, this is when crack was emerging as a problem. And of course, we had the 1982 survey that didn't mention crack. And then the 1985 survey was coming into its design stages, which also didn't have anything about crack, but it was too late to change it because of the lead time required. And then the next survey that was scheduled was 1988. So, and of course, we you collect the survey in 88, and we wouldn't have any data until probably 1989. So this was a long time to get data on crack, and so it was realized that maybe we need to do the survey more often. So that's when it began. There began to be a push for more frequent conduct of the survey, and there were many debates about how frequently that should be. But then also the size of the survey, because of the crack numbers and the need to break it out geographically and ethnically and age-wise, the survey was just too small in those early days. So there was a big push to expand the survey. And particularly the one big event that happened in the 80s was in 1986 when Len Bias died of a cocaine overdose. And that was a pretty big wake-up call for the country and for the government. And it led to a lot of funding increases in the government. Was big news at the time when he overdosed. He was a number one draft choice for out of college. You just graduated from the University of Maryland, and he was drafted by the Boston Celtics, and everybody was anticipating he's going to be the next superstar in an NBA. And there he was, gone from a drug, a cocaine overdose, which really at the time many people didn't feel like regular casual cocaine use was that dangerous, and changed a lot of people's attitudes. And it was something that we actually could see in the data in terms of the attitude data, perceived harm, for example, asking people how much harm they perceived in if they were taking cocaine. And it really jumped up significantly right after that.
That seems like a big shift, though, to go from every 3 years to suddenly needing the survey to be so much more frequent and so much bigger. Is the survey now currently annual, biannual? What changed this made to the timing of the survey, and how much did that complicate your life if it takes so long to design this thing?
Yeah, well, the survey was done every 2 or 3 years with a sample of about, it had reached about 8,000 per year by 88 and 90. So right after the overdose and the national attention on the cocaine problem and other drugs too. That's when one of the things that happened was the Office of National Drug Control Policy was created out of the White House. And with their legislation, they had a requirement to collect data and use data to assess the problem, set goals, and track how they're meeting those goals. And so as soon as they were created, they were staffing up, and they immediately started calling me and others at NIDA about the data. Can you do the survey every year? Can you expand the sample? And this is what created a lot of disagreements and differing opinions about what should happen. A lot of people at NIDA, particularly some of the researchers, the grantees of NIDA, felt like that was too much money to put into the survey. It should go into some other kinds of smaller studies. But ONDCP was persistent, and after it took a little time, it was gradual. The survey became annual starting in 1990. They demanded a 91 survey. We had already planned 80 and 88 and 90. And they demanded that the next contract be a 91 and then a 92. And eventually it was also expanded to become much bigger. And this all happened during the 80s. And then there was also interest in expanding it to the point where we could have state-level data. In other words, certain data collected in every state, estimates for every state, partly because of the funding of treatment programs from the federal government was done through a block grant to states with not a whole lot of monitoring, but and not a whole lot of data that was comparable. States had their own data, but you couldn't compare one state to another. So you needed a national survey done with the same methodology across all the states in order to make comparisons. So that was what was eventually implemented in 1999. And since that, since 1999, there, the other change that happened in that same year was that the survey was converted from a paper and pencil with the answer sheets put in the envelopes to a computerized interview where the same self-administration was done, but it was done on a laptop computer. And pretty much since that time, the survey has been the same methodology.
So do you, in order to do this survey, in order to bring these laptops into people's homes to ask them these questions, do you hire a ground force of people, almost like the census is done every 10 years? Does the survey itself have employees that go out and go into the field? How do you actually collect the answers, and who does that?
Yeah, well, it's nowhere near as big as the census, but it's a similar kind of thing. What we did, starting in 1999, we went under contract that we managed in-house in the government. We had a staff of about 10 people, that 10 or 12, that would manage the entire project. And the contractor would do the hiring of the field staff. And they started out in that year were about 1,000 interviewers. Basically, they had a small independent survey of at least 1,000 people in every state in the country and DC. Now the design of it and the way it was collected evolve over the years, and they were able to do the survey with more like 600 interviewers a year. And that's about where they are now, around 600. And it's a huge management issue. There's field supervisors in every state, and there are training sessions throughout the year, a big training session of the entire field staff every January, and then periodic trainings to hire new staff when there's turnover. And so it is a pretty big project. And every interviewer is given a laptop computer as well as a handheld device, now cell phones, to track the management of the field work. But the actual interview is done on a laptop computer, and it's all programmed so that the questions come up on the screen, interviewer, and it's also a recorded interview. So there are, it's voice recorded. For a few years, we actually had a person who would record every question, and that would be all pieced together on the laptop. Later on, we eventually used some voice electronically generated voices when the technology reached, you know, the quality we needed. So the respondents could wear headphones and actually do the whole interview without being able to read the screen. And that allowed us to include poor readers or non-readers to do the interview.
That's amazing. So it's very accessible. That's great. So in your book's subtitle, you note that culture and politics have shaped the survey. To me, as a non-statistician, statistics often seem like they're outside of political and cultural influence, but you seem to be arguing that they aren't. So how have culture and politics influenced NISDA, the survey?
Well, I like to say it didn't have much influence, but it was it was a battle. And actually that was one of the main reasons I wrote the book, was because it was so interesting to see how that whole conflict played out between the politicians, statisticians. It's kind of like the same thing we hear about today, the politicians versus the science. And because the survey work, survey design, it really is kind of a science. So these methodologies, like using the answer sheets and the laptop computer, the way the questions are worded, the way the questionnaire is structured, other things like how we approach the respondents with our initial letters, inviting them to participate, and the incentives like payments that are given to respondents. All these things were tested scientifically and evaluated, and were built, you know, according to these scientific results. And so when OND and they wanted the survey added and they wanted certain questions added or changed, they pushed us to make these changes right away. And some of the changes were bad ideas. Some of the changes were things that needed to be developed and tested and would take a few years, and they were impatient about that. So there was a lot of back and forth, and we compromised on some things, but we never really compromised on the science. But we did make, you know, certain content changes in the questionnaire. So the politics, the politicians did affect the survey. And at the same time, I mean, as statisticians running the survey, we were always interested and felt like it was our responsibility to provide the data that was needed by whoever, researchers, politicians. And so we did make real efforts to include what they were interested in, as long as it was done in a way that collected valid data and gave useful results. On the other end of the study, you have the reporting of the results, which is a major part of our jobs too. We were the producers of the statistical reports that reported the results of the survey. And when it comes down to interpretation, you know, looking at the statistical significance, looking at the methodologies and how they affected the results, and acknowledging that there's definitely some underreporting, but we had a hard time measuring it. And so, of course, we couldn't always control what the politicians would report on the survey, particularly the politicians outside of the executive branch. I mean, there was some coordination within the executive branch, but even there, ONDCP sometimes, you know, made statements that we wouldn't have necessarily agreed with, and you know, we dealt with that. We stuck to our guns, tried to stay out of trouble with them, but they, for the most part, they were pretty pretty good about it, but there were times when the political forces got, you know, in the way of the correct reporting of the results.
Sure. I want to talk more about what happens to the information the survey generates, it, who uses it, and for what purposes. But very briefly, I kind of want to go back to something you said before, where you're talking about, you know, certain politicians would be pushing you to include certain things, you know, what they were interested in. And that feels very similar to what essentially Nixon was trying to do, to use this survey to generate the information he wanted about marijuana and its potential dangers, right, and its links to criminality and deviant behavior and all of that. So it seems like this is a problem the survey has run into time and time again from its very inception. But could you give us an example of, I don't want to get you into any trouble, you don't have to name names, but could you give us an example of something that you were pushed to include by some higher-ups? What did politicians want the survey to ask about that had not been included before?
Let's see. I think there were things that they wanted to ask about that we didn't have enough sample for, and they were just too rare. And there were things that were very difficult to measure, and we had a lot of trouble, for example, coming up with a definition of trauma, which more recently with the mental health interest, there was a lot of interest in measuring trauma, but we could never really come up with a measurable definition that everybody agreed with. And another topic of interest was treatment need, and there were disagreements about how that would be measured, and it was difficult to get at that. I don't think there were any examples of really bad things that they wanted included. It was more that they, it's not like they wanted to see certain results so that they could, say that marijuana is bad. They were more thinking of what was needed, what was needed, however it came out. I can't say that in my experience there was a whole lot of thinking ahead of, what can we collect that will enhance our position, making a certain argument. I never had experience with anything like what Nixon did before my time.
Maybe that's good to hear, right? that's reassuring.
But I will say that with the way there's so much information, the questionnaire has so much information, and adding a few more things, you can even get more information, that you can always find something in the data to support your position. It doesn't mean that should be the focus of the reporting of the results. We didn't do it that way, but there would always be ways that people could find something in the data and they would use that to make an argument. Sometimes it was inappropriate because it was based on too small a sample, and we would have to make a comment about that. But that was one way that, some of these things created situations where there were disagreements.
Well, so, that, I think, leads to our next conversation topic quite logically. What happens to the information the survey generates? Who are you creating it for? Who uses it? And for what purposes?
Well, that's a good question, because it's probably another area of, I don't know if I'd say disagreement, but it's been a problem in that I think the data underused, and if it could be made more accessible, the data files for researchers to analyze, I think it would greatly it would create a lot of good research and would be very useful. And that's been pretty weak in terms of government support and funding of that aspect of it. But there are multiple audiences, and the researchers is one audience, but the main audience, the most important audience, is the policymakers, the people who make decisions, Congress and the White House, and local leaders, state leaders, who need data to track problems, look at, what are the emerging problems that need a change in policy or a change in attention by the government, and also what policies in terms of treatment availability, and where is treatment needed, what populations need treatment, what are the prevention messages that might be helpful to get people to not use drugs and to stay out of trouble with drugs. All these things that are involved in different aspects of drug policy that could benefit from from solid data. And this is just one source of data that can be used in conjunction with others. There's a major survey of high school students done by the University of Michigan under a grant with NIDA called Monitoring the Future. And there's, of course, the drug overdose data that's used. There's lots of data that's collected in treatment programs on people coming into treatment, what drug problem they have, and whether how long they stay in treatment, and things, characteristics of treatment programs, what services they provide, where they're located, is it accessible? So there are lots of different data that can be pulled together and used for policy purposes.
And 50 years of it, which is really pretty remarkable. So you had mentioned before a little bit about how, you know, someone could look at the survey data and kind of find whatever they want within it to support their position, regardless of what their position might be. Could you give us an example maybe of how this information has been, I don't know if I should say misused or used selectively for specific and perhaps political purposes?
Yeah, well, one example would be right after ONDCP was created. And in fact, I think the first release of data from this survey, after ONDCP was created, of course, this was a time when in the 80s when cocaine was the issue, and everybody was expecting that the survey would show big increases in cocaine use, and partly because of the declines after Len Bias overdosed. It really turned out that way when we sent the PCP, he went down. They confused at first, they didn't see the data. They decided to force the data. They didn't want to change any data, but they still wanted to make the point that the cocaine problem was getting worse. And in some ways it was, because the overdose data, the emergency department overdose data, as well as the death data and the treatment data, were showing more people with cocaine problems. But the survey was showing fewer people using cocaine. So it was kind of a dilemma. And the way they solved it was they characterized the cocaine problem as a two-part problem. There was casual use and there was hardcore use. And so the casual use was going down and the hardcore use was going up. And they searched for and identified some specific items in the survey that did show that things were not getting better, that things were slightly increasing. And that was frequent cocaine use, which was defined at that time as weekly use or more than 50 times in a year of cocaine among cocaine users, and that was going up. And so they pulled that out and they focused on that. And this is where the data were true. It was, it was statistically significant, and so it was reportable. But on the other hand, it was a very small sample. You know, we only had 8,000 respondents, and out of that, only a handful were you know, frequent cocaine users. But nevertheless, you know, they highlighted that, and they actually made comments. Oh, this was when Bill Bennett was the ONDCP director. They actually kind of dissed the survey and saying it's no good for picking up hardcore use. And they actually started funding some special studies, finding other ways of getting estimates of hardcore use as an adjunct to the survey. So it was an interesting time, and that whole idea of the duality of the drug problem kind of persisted for a while, and eventually the survey size, when it got much, much bigger, we did have a better tracking of drug problematic drug use in the survey, and were able to estimate how many people were dependent on different drugs. And surprisingly, found like over 2 million people were dependent on marijuana, even though, and this was based on medical criteria of what dependence, you know, that defined what dependence was. So that was kind of surprising to people, but so that was an example of how ONDCP pulled out a certain data to make the point that they wanted to make.
Sure. And were those adjacent surveys then removed or ended after NISDA was expanded, or are those adjacent ones still being used?
Well, you mean the hardcore drug use study? They never really got it underway because it turned out to do it the way they did it. They did an example study in Chicago, and it required a lot of data collection from different emergency departments, treatment centers, jails, and homeless. And they tried to get all that. And it cost a lot of money. And so in terms of making that nationwide, it would have been extremely expensive. So, but other methods that were used that could be used to look at the hardcore drug use, and which actually is another issue, is how do you even define hardcore drug use? It's not a technical term, and there are different studies that use different definitions. But the one thing that we've done with the survey is tried to keep the methodology consistent from year to year. Even when you expanded the sample, we try to keep the way of collecting and analyzing the data consistent, which allowed us to track trends. And so acknowledging the undercount of heroin addicts and even heavy cocaine users in the survey, we could at least say that we're doing it the same way every year so we can look at trends. And so that became, you know, much more useful to look at the trends in those more rare and hardcore type drug use patterns.
Let's go back and talk a bit about you again. How does a statistician come to write a book about drugs? What did you want to write this book for, and who did you want to write this book for?
Well, the reason I wrote the book was for a couple of reasons. One was because I felt like there were so many interesting stories to tell, war stories about the drug war and the policies and what was going on in the government. I knew that a lot of it wasn't really known by the general public and even by people that were involved in the survey. But I mean, I had involvement at every level of the project, being in charge of early stages. I was involved in the detailed parts of the study. I knew every aspect of how it was done, and that continued until later years when it was bigger and it got more attention, and I was the official that had to go and brief the drug czars and the secretaries of HHS on the results, and I have conversations with them about the data, and so I could translate that back into, well, what should we do with the survey reporting and design based on what they said. And so all of these stories, which I had documented, I had notes from all these events that occurred, and emails and memos, and I felt like I should preserve it. And there wasn't much preservation going on in the government at the time. There was more interest in getting rid of paper and books and reports and digitizing everything and putting it on files, which I think are a little harder to find, and some of it wasn't even being saved. So, and when I retired, I had all this information, and I knew there would be people interested in it, particularly survey statisticians, people working on other surveys would learn from some of these experiences, and particularly people who worked in the drug field would learn how the data came about. And it's interesting that, for me, I think There's a few. I've met a handful of others, but there's a saying among survey statisticians too, that statistician is a great job because you get to play in everyone else's backyard, which means that it's a skill and a field that you can apply to economics, you can apply to health, you can apply to business practices, and just about anything you can think of, sports, of course, baseball. And so there are statisticians, and many statisticians work as consultants, and they work in all these different backyards. But it's not so common to find statisticians who stick with one study their whole career, and that's, I think, a real benefit to the project, because there are really things that, you know, I found when we bring in consultants from other, you know, general backgrounds who weren't necessarily familiar with the drug field, it took them some time to learn about the issues and how the data and statistical issues, you know, were special for this particular field. And they would never come up to speed fully. And so I felt like we had an advantage in myself and a few other people who worked on the survey for, you know, a long time and became familiar with the details and understood how statistical practices could, you know, really apply to this particular project.
Well, Joe, we've taken up a lot of your time. But before we go, I want to thank you as a drug historian for writing this book and collecting these stories. I think the surveys about drug use, like Monitoring the Future and NISDA, have been incredibly important to my work and my research. And the fact that you've had, you know, the firsthand front row you know, witness and sort of ability to write this testimonial to the history of this remarkable, if kind of on the low key, sort of not fully understood phenomenon, is amazing. It is a service to drug historians and will be for a long time in the future. But before I let you go, I'd like to ask our traditional last question here on the New Books Network. I know you're retired, so you might not be, you know, you know, you might have a different answer, but what are you working on right now? What can I expect to interview about later on?
Well, I don't think you probably won't want to do any more interviews, because I haven't really been working in the drug field. For several years, let's see, I retired in early 2014, and for the next 4 or 5 years, I worked as a consultant. So I was still involved in the survey in many different aspects, including with the National Institute on Mental Health, with their use of the NISDA data, and also Bureau of Justice Statistics on a study to use the NISDA data to construct a way of estimating mental illness among prisoners, inmates. So I enjoyed all of that work, but it kind of came to an end, and so I just sort of haven't really been doing any statistical work other than reading a few things here and there and getting interested in how the government's been using the COVID data too. That was frustrating. But right now, my next, I guess you could call it a book, it's turning into a book, is a family history story. I'm working on a detailed family history story, looking at my ancestors, where they lived and where they worked. And kind of like the drug book, it's what I'm trying to do is to tie in the family story with other historical events and trends that were occurring at the time and where they were living and how it affected their lives. So it's in a similar in a way, but it's not going to be a public book. I'll be just distributing it within the family.
Well, it sounds like a great project and a worthy use of your time. I want to thank you so much again for coming on the show, for telling us your war stories, and for writing this book. I highly recommend our listeners check it out. It's an extraordinary chapter of American drug history that you've really brought to life. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for doing the interview.